So I guess we can begin. So in the last lecture, we were introduced to a phenomenon, I don't know what to call it, a phenomenology called entanglement farming, which is how two particle detectors that can be space-like separated, even as in like they will never know from each other existence, can start in a separable state. And through their interaction locally with the field, they can become entangled. That's what I call entanglement harvesting. I presented a little bit of how the calculations go. You should be able to reproduce all those calculations. There's nothing mysterious in them. There's no tricks, no assumptions. It's hard and boring, I guess, math, like dealing with horrible integrals, but integrals that are doable, integrals that are easy to evaluate if you have a computer, and most of the times even analytically evaluable in closed form. So you could reproduce everything and convince yourselves that, wow, this thing happens. Again, I gave you a simple model that demystify a little bit what it is. What we are doing with that is using or collecting, if you want, the entanglement that is present in the ground state of the field. All right. Today, we're going to do a couple more things. I had to choose what to do. And I guess I went with a little bit of results on fundamental aspects, we're going to see a couple plots and a couple comments on that. I'm going to present you with a protocol of, I'm going to mention a couple of reference of experimental implementations, as in proposals of experimental implementations. One in quantum optics, the other one in superconducting circuits. And finally, what I will do is I will tell you about a protocol called entanglement farming, and that will allow me to introduce some concepts and notions that are useful tools in RQI that unfortunately we don't have time in the course to go over, but I think it will be interesting to talk about a little bit anyways. All right. So here's a little plot. Maybe someone at the back would recognize it, I don't know. This plot is a binary plot in the sense that there are only two colors. On gray, we have regions where entanglement harvesting is not possible. Regions in the space of parameters. What are those parameters? So this parameter is the delay between the two detectors. Like we picked this one because it's nicer. I mean, to show is a nicer one. The delay between the two, remember the two detectors in these typical scenarios are co-moving. So they share a reference frame. They're inertial and co-moving. This means that the delay in units of T, which is the amount of time they're switched on. That's the scale that I've been calling sigma in the thermalization studies. So two identical detectors. Omega is the energy gap. Of course, in unison, everything is dimensionalized with the scale of duration of the interaction. So omega is the gap of the detector. D is the spatial distance of separation between the detectors. So the detectors are extended. And the light cone goes around here, around distance 8. If they're farther apart than 8, this is an adiabatic switching, by the way. If they're farther apart than 8, they are space-like separated, effectively. We see here that it is possible to harvest entanglement. So if you give me a separation, if you're in Australia and I'm here, can we still harvest entanglement from the field? And in principle, theoretically speaking, the answer is yes, you can. Look at that. This thing will go, you will get into the regime of entanglement harvesting. What you need to do, though, is increase the gap between the detectors. If you increase the gap between the detectors, then you will make it possible to harvest entanglement for longer distances. One way of making sense of that intuitively is, well, the gap protects you against the local noise. The farther apart are the levels, the less likely it is that you get excited to the excited state through the local noise mechanism. However, of course, it's not for free. Entanglement harvesting, the amount of entanglement that you can harvest decrease exponentially as you go farther away and very fast with the gap. So you pay a price. You can definitely harvest space-like entanglement as far as you want, but only tiny bits if you go too far, okay? All right, so a little bit of a summary of references. The first one is not really unruly detectors. I mean, you may recognize Anthony Valentini, used to be here as well, some time ago. Anthony Valentini was the first person who actually found this thing called entanglement. I mean, it's not been called entanglement harvesting until, I would say, 2012-13. Anthony Valentini just observed it, doing interactions which are electromagnetic in nature, although not considering anything regarding the internal structure of the atoms. And in that paper by Anthony Valentini, the claims are there. If you read the abstract even, Anthony Valentini doesn't mention the word entanglement, maybe reasons for it, I don't know. But Anthony Valentini mentions two atoms can acquire non-classical correlations. Oh, non-classical uses? Well, I don't remember what word he uses. Doesn't mention the word entanglement. Correlations, even when they are space-like separated. Okay? That paper was not read much and forgotten. Benny Resnick, forgotten in the sense of Benny Resnick, the next person talking about it, didn't cite Anthony Valentini. Benny Resnick found independently that this thing happens. In fact, Anthony Valentini kind of joined all the references in this kinds of works around this paper because it was basically some colleague of mine, Achim Kempf, that attended a talk. No, that gave a talk where he mentioned entanglement harvesting. Anthony Valentini was in the audience and said, but I found that in the 90s already. Actually in the 80s, but it was published in the 90s. And he's like, oh, really? And then Anthony gave us that reference and I presented that reference to Resnick and other people. And he was like, oh, right. So yeah, it's kind of interesting. He was the first person to find it. Benny Resnick didn't know that and derived it independently. The paper by Benny Resnick is the one that caught up in the field and was known. But nowadays we know the history, even the hidden history of harvesting. You can say that it was independently developed with 12 years of difference, but independently developed the idea between Anthony Valentini and Benny Resnick. Now, there's been a lot of work since then. Many things have been done and better understood by far. We know that we can do it with electromagnetic fields and atoms, as in like hydrogen atoms with the full angular momentum structure. And the two things I'm going to show you a little... experimental proposals, for sure. So here we have two experimental proposals for entanglement harvesting. One is based on quantum optics, but can be also exported to other setups. This one in particular, both of them actually can do... this one in particular is focused on time-like entanglement harvesting, which is kind of cool still. This one can be done... This can be done also space-like, but this is focused on time-like. This is both time-like and space-like. I guess you can sell it to popular science easily, the time-like one, although it sounds less impressive, I guess, because you're in the light cone of each other. You can say, I'm entangling a single atom with its future self, right? And then people are like, which is what you're doing. You have one atom, and then you can violate Bell inequalities with measurements in the past and measurements in the future's correlations, if you want them. This, again, you can, in principle, in this paper we discussed that with current technology is doable. There's someone at the IQC that's interested in actually doing it, and they're trying. I mean, it can be done with current technology, but experiments are tricky. So working on it, this is with superconducting qubits. So basically, you couple two artificial atoms to a transmission line, you have a quantized field in that transmission line, and the two artificial atoms, the nice thing with superconducting qubits is that you can switch on and off the interaction very fast and very controlled. There's a recent Nature Physics that actually, with an experimental Nature Physics of this person at the IQC and other people, some of the co-authors here as well, Borja, Pero Padre as well, showing that they can actually implement ultra-strong switchable coupling. So very strong coupling that they can switch on and off at will. So yeah, those are like the two main test beds. I'm hoping that we will see an experiment that demonstrates space-like entanglement harvesting soon-ish, okay? Kind of promise a date, though. Oh yeah, and I have these two things, right, that I'm gonna talk a little bit about. Sensitivity of entanglement harvesting to geometry and topology. So let me just illustrate this with a couple plots. Here we have simple scenario. So we're working with entanglement harvesting from the conformal vacuum in ADS, in the sitter, and a thermostat in Minkowski. Why do I say that? Okay, locally, Are you familiar with something called the Gibbons-Hawking effect? Have you ever heard that before? How many people have heard that? Yes to no? Okay. So let me just tell you. So if you have a detector, remember that we saw the Andrew effect, huh? We also saw a little bit of the Hawking radiation effect, or the Hawking radiation. Imagine that I have a detector that is coupled to the conformal vacuum in the Sitter space. That detector coupled to the conformal vacuum, what would be the response of such a detector? So Gibbons and Hawking, they published a paper in when they derive actually two ways, a canon kind of way, as in canon, as in similar to the first derivation of the Andrew effect, and the second bit with detectors, that the response of a detector in a de Sitter background coupled to the conformal vacuum is thermal. It's actually, that's a KMS state again, and the detector thermalizes with it. You see a thermal distribution that is related with the scale of the thermality is related to the Hubble length. So the cosmological constant in the Sitter, if you want. And this effect is related to, well, again, you can associate it to the presence of horizons for observers if you want. But basically what this is telling you is that a detector will see a thermal state. Now, question that you can ask. Imagine that I have a detector in a Minkowski background where I prepare a thermal state, a KMS state, with a temperature equal to the Gibbons-Hawking temperature of a given universe. And I compare that scenario with a detector interacting with the conformal vacuum in a de Sitter universe. What is the response like? The response is identical. The detectors cannot see, one single detector on forever cannot distinguish between a thermal state associated with the time-like vector, the time therefore velocity, and being coupled to the conformal vacuum and being comoving and seeing a thermal state. It's indistinguishable. All right, in both cases, the response is thermal and identical. Now, Nekmenikuchi and Versteg, I don't know, I mean, my Dutch is not great, found that actually, if you do entanglement harvesting, it is possible to distinguish the two scenarios. The regions of entanglement are different if you have the Sitter space or a thermal state in Minkowskian background. So I'm not going to tell you too much about it, but the interesting thing is that you could do in principle an experiment, in principle, because big scale kind of experiment. You have satellites for a long time separated, and then they do this entanglement harvesting protocol. You can actually notice the difference in a bilocal kind of experiment. You can notice the difference between the geometry of the Sitter spacetime and Minkowski spacetime when the response of a single detector is the same and thermal. And here's another plot. So here you have a difference in correlation. So if you want difference in the entanglement, I got these plots because they're clearer, but difference in the correlators, in the two-point correlators of the detectors, of the observables of the detectors, same happens with entanglement. We have here, there's a relative difference, sorry, this is an absolute difference. No, this is the relative one, sorry. In the correlators between detectors in M and M minus and M and M zero. So M is Minkowski spacetime, okay? All those cases are flat spacetimes, all of them. One is the usual topology of Minkowski spacetime. Now, M0 here is the Einstein cylinder, if you want. So M0 is a cylinder topology on Minkowski spacetime. Still flat, but in a cylinder kind of topology. And M minus is a Möbius strip kind of topology. So instead of doing the cylinder, you flip it and do the cylinder to do the identification. Now, in these three cases, the length scales, I don't have much of the study, but the length scales of the topological length scales, as in like how long would it take if I'm in the cylinder for me to see a signal come back to me, those lengths are much, much larger. I have another plot about that, much larger than the separation between the detectors that are doing entanglement harvesting. And entanglement harvesting is very sensitive. You see, in the regions that you cannot do entanglement harvesting, well, of course, the difference is zero, but when you can do entanglement harvesting, you have regions that the difference, you can get difference of even 10%. Of course, this is kind of misleading if I don't show you scales, So here you go, the sensitivity to the topological parameters. So let's call L the topological parameter. So if in sensitivity, so the sensitivity to the topological parameter is huge, this sigma is associated this sigma is the non-locality scale. This is flipped. And this L is associated with the length of separation of the detectors. And as you can see here, always keeping it below, you get, of course, the entanglement harvesting. It's actually inverted, what I'm saying, right? So L, it's related, my bad. L is related to the length scale of the topological, because the larger the scale, the smaller the correlators with the difference with Minkowski in the periodic case, in the Einstein cylinder. Yeah, so in this case, one sees that it's true that with this length scale, it goes down very fast. Unfortunately, here I only have the values that are below. This is sad. Basically, to see something, in principle, you should do an experiment at least of a separation which is two orders of magnitude below the length scale of the topological length scale associated with the problem. So in principle, with a single detector, your best hope is to wait of the order of the topological scale. With two detectors, you don't need to wait of the order of the topological scale. You can do it a couple orders of magnitude below. So if you can do that with two detectors, one could think that maybe we can harvest higher order correlations and increase the non-locality of the measurement. Yes, go for it.
What is theta and epsilon zero squared along?
There's theta? No, there's no theta here. The C, that's the correlator.
Epsilon zero and theta.
Epsilon zero is the coupling strength.
He means the x-axis.
Yeah.
Ah, directionality. This, because this is showing the directionality as well. So interesting enough, a topological modification on flat spacetime. So if you just use a different topology and you do an identification only in one dimension, you are extremely sensitive to the direction. So doing entanglement harvesting with one detector, you are not sensitive to direction. But with two detectors, you can align them. So of course, two detectors are always aligned. So the relative orientation of the line between the two detectors are where the topological identification happens. It's seen a lot by entanglement harvesting. So entanglement harvesting distinguishes directionality, can detect anisotropy. I wasn't looking at this. I was thinking you were asking about that. Entanglement harvesting it's very directional, distinguishes direction. And keep in mind, we're doing it in scalar field. There's nothing, we're not using the full advantage that we have vector fields, and we can actually use different orientations of even orbitals if we had atoms, actually. This is just the direction of the two detectors, the line between the two detectors. And this is the angle between the direction in which you implement the topological identification and the two detectors. So yeah, you are sensitive to the you can see directionalities with entanglement harvesting.
What are the three lines?
Different scales. So because this plot is not the best to illustrate the point that you can actually see it for very long topological scales. Sigma is associated with the time the detectors are on. I mean, these detectors can be point-like. So let me just do a sigma, which is the time that the detectors are on as a scale, the non-locality scale of the detectors, if you want. How long the detectors are is how long they're on. And L is the length of the topological length scale. So how long it would take for me to go half a period on the topology.
For a cylinder right now.
That's right. Okay. So this is M0 is the cylinder. Now, here, it doesn't really illustrate very well at all that you can actually see it below the scales, because as you can see here, those scales, this detector actually gets even to contact, here is kind of almost full contact with the, it's at the point of full contact because it's half a period, yeah. So, this doesn't illustrate that you can actually see it for lengths that are much smaller than the time that the detectors are on. I'm telling you that, you can check the paper too. It's a couple orders of magnitude. You can actually, in principle, see it with a difference of more than 2% for a couple orders of magnitude when one L is a couple orders of magnitude above sigma. Here, what it illustrates here, though, is the directionality. So the fact that you can actually distinguish directions with entanglement harvesting. If you have a topological identification in one direction, you can actually align your detectors and find it. All right.
If you had more detectors?
Yes, I was saying that. So the cheat here, if you want, is that we increase the non-locality of my measure. There are two ways to increase non-locality. One is just wait a long time or have a big detector. The detector is coupled to more of the fields, is more non-local, gathers more non-local information. Another way is like, well, do bilocal stuff. So get two detectors and couple them and see their correlations. That's a bilocal measurement. In principle, if you keep adding detectors, one would expect that you increase the non-locality of this. So if you want to do a measure that is measurement that is localized in less space and time, but still gather more non-local information, look at higher order correlators. The main thing is that something like the vacuum or any state that's stationary is equilibrated with space-time. That's why it's stationary. Therefore, all the information, look how all the correlators had information about thermality. That's actually kind of cool. Like when we saw KMS, we saw that all the correlators of all observables have information about thermality. The equilibration process has affected the whole system. There is information locally of what happens far away as well, because of this thermalization process. The thermalization process equilibrated the whole thing. Now, it's very difficult to read local information, non-local information with local measurements. But you can increase the non-locality of your measurements without increasing the length in space and time of your measurement using time harvesting with many detectors. So anyway, the expectation is that you should be able to gather more information when you have more detectors coupled, and you could look at higher order correlations, not just bipartite correlation.
Have they done this calculation?
No. There's some things that have been done, but no, not yet.
Do you think like it'll be possible if you have like 10 detectors to bring down 20 orders of magnitude?
No. I don't think it'll go as easy as that. Also you have to keep in mind that the more detectors you add, the more suppressed are the correlations because the coupling strengths are low. And in order to look for the four-partite correlations, you need order four coupling strengths together. Okay, so the effects will be decreased. But in principle, the information is there, and there's a way to get it. So I would not expect miraculous results. But yes, I mean, the order of magnitude, given your ability to see it, the order of magnitude of reduction of difference of scales will increase, yeah. Only it will become more difficult to see. All right, questions so far? Didn't get too much into the, was hoping to do more, but time. Yeah? Questions about that, not those questions of yours.
Suppression from the coupling strength.
So in order for one detector, so the correlations between the two detectors, remember they don't exist at the beginning. They are acquired through interactions with the field. To interact with the field in detector A and acquire correlations with detector B, you need terms of order lambda A, lambda B. Because if you make lambda B zero, it's like removing one of the detectors, there will be no correlations. Now, those are the bipartite correlations. If you want four-partite correlations, you need lambda A, lambda B, lambda C, lambda D. So if your coupling strength is already small, the more higher order correlations that you want to look at, the more difficult it'll become. Now, if your coupling strength is huge, though, it may be even better. So there are setups, experimental setups, though, not just in cosmology, where you actually couple very strongly to the field. And in those ones, yeah, measuring higher order correlations makes sense. All right. So a question that we can ask is, I mean, it was asked before, like, what are the limits? Can you really extract and distill entanglement from these kinds of things? Can you repeat the process cyclically? Imagine that I have a cavity, a finite region of space-time, or at least space, and I just keep trying to harvest entanglement from it. Can I do this without exhausting the entanglement? So all these questions, you see, cannot be responded easily within perturbation theory. If you keep hitting with a small hammer many, many times, there's a movie about a spoon. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's ridiculous. So people murderers that are like really, really vicious, and they kill people by hitting them with spoons, like going with them in their lives and hitting them with spoons until they kill them. My point is a perturbative effect built up in time becomes non-perturbative. Okay? So perturbation theory might not be enough. Anyway, we'll see. Now, question, can we do sustainable entanglement harvesting? The quick answer, we're going to get into more details. Quick answer, no, not just with this kind of non-communicating mechanism alone. In truth, indeed, entanglement resources get exhausted. So there's an entropy buildup in the cavity. If the cavity is ideal, you have heating and mixedness, okay? But if you combine the two, so if you have entanglement harvesting and also communication, it is possible to do it in a sustainable way. And that's what we're going to see now. We're going to see how to do these kind of things in a sustainable way. What is called entanglement farming. Right, again, not surprisingly, we need to go beyond usual approximations in quantum optics to do this. Let's see, in particular, what people do. Just a quick summary. So, in a fully relativistic approach, the usual approximations break down. Okay, the two first, rotating wave approximation and single mode break down, for sure. If we want to build up an effect that is big, the perturbative approach may break down as well. So there are effects not predicted by the approximated theory. For example, you get a dynamical Casimir effect. That's one of them. You cannot get dynamical Casimir effect with rotating wave approximations. Okay. Let's find out a little bit about those approximations. Let's get some insight. I mean, not really insight, but what we do when they fail. We already got some insight in previous lectures. So what do you do when rotating wave approximation or a few mode approximation fails? Usually what you do is what we did before. You go to perturbation theory. So you assume that whatever you're doing, your interaction is very small as compared to the dynamics, the natural dynamics of the system. You're doing a small perturbation. Now, what if you go to a regime where perturbation theory fails? There are many ways to do detector field calculation in non-perturbative regimes, luckily. They've been developed throughout the years, all right? One of them, the one that I'm going to mention a little bit about because it's useful, is harmonic models and Gaussian methods. You know anything about Gaussian quantum mechanics? Have you seen anything like that? I mean, you have seen distributions in phase space. Interesting, the distributions in phase space for thermal states, for coherent states, for squeezed states, they were Gaussian, right? Yep. So, Gaussians are particularly simple, no? Gaussians as functions, how much information do you need to reproduce an arbitrary function? Infinite. How much information, no, and not as if the function is not band limited, I mean, free function, any function. How much information you need to reconstruct a Gaussian? Huh? Well, in one dimension, yeah, two. You need where it's centered, and you need all the second moments. So all the variances in all the directions. So if in one dimension you need to reconstruct a function, you just need two numbers, as you said. Well, that's kind of interesting. This is kind of what we're going to follow, but it doesn't really matter. Right, Gaussian methods in quantum mechanics. Yeah, quantum mechanics, we can agree that is from the computational point of view is tough, right? Say that you have a set of n harmonic oscillators, then you have infinite dimensions in your Hilbert space. Taking partial traces, have you done many partial traces of systems that are big? That's tough. You know why? Because density matrices live in a tensor product space. And tracing out in tensor product spaces is complicated. This is complicated, I mean by that, computationally complicated. Let alone if those Hilbert spaces are infinite dimensional. Now, maybe we don't need the whole Hilbert space, right? Maybe we can just narrow our focus to Gaussian states. Why? Why would we want to narrow our focus to Gaussian state? Well, there are many states that are interesting and Gaussian. For example, thermal states, free thermal states. Let's understand free fields here. We're talking free fields. Coherent states, squeezed thermal states, displaced squeezed states, or squeezed coherent states, these kinds of things, right? As an example of actually all of them, you also get the vacuum state of a free theory. The vacuum state is a Gaussian state. If you want, it's a coherent state of amplitude zero. is a squeezed vacuum, a squeezed state center at zero with squeezing parameter zero. It's a thermostate, it's a zero temperature thermostate. So the vacuum is a thermostate. Right. A zero mean Gaussian state can be characterized, like the vacuum, can be characterized by its first and second moments. That's what we said. So, well, if it's centered at zero, the first moment is zero. So all that we need is to collect the second moments. The second moment, we can, there are several different conventions as to how to build this. All of them is gathering the second moment one way or another. Let's make a collection of these second moments, all right? And we call, by the way, that we call a covariance matrix. Have you heard those words before? A matrix of covariances. We store the covariances there. So in mind that I have a set of n plus n harmonic oscillators. N plus n because I want to single out detectors maybe from field modes. So for now, n plus n harmonic oscillators. So here's a vector x that contains all the positions and the momenta for all those harmonic oscillators. Again, this is square root 2 here. Sometimes there's not. People use different conventions. So when you check formulas in Gaussian quantum mechanics, make sure that you look the convention. All right? There are many, many different there are three main conventions. 1/2, 1, or square root 2. Those three are used, unfortunately. Right. Now, cool. You can store all the information you need for a Gaussian state in a covariance matrix and perhaps a translation vector. So the center, a vector, and a matrix. That would be all okay, but if my time evolution takes me from Gaussian states to non-Gaussian states, I've lost the power. I mean, my time evolution just is no longer, my state becomes no longer a Gaussian state. I need more numbers to store. Now, theorem, lucky theorem. If your Hamiltonian is quadratic in the quadratures, in x's and p's, then Gaussianity is preserved. Time evolution generated by quadratic Hamiltonians maps Gaussian states to Gaussian states. So the evolution and the quadratic Hamiltonians remains Gaussian. Now, interesting enough, the Andrew DeWitt coupling is quadratic. We're coupling, remember, a phi, which is an x, if you want, or a collection of x's. We're coupling them with a sigma x, if you want, of the detector. We have a coupling of the form like this. Okay, or if you want, like this. We have sigma minus couples to a's and a daggers, sigma plus couples to a's and a daggers. It's a quadratic couple. Only that, a two-level system is not a harmonic oscillator. Okay, let's modify a little bit the Andrew DeWitt model. It's been done before. And instead of considering a two-level system, a qubit, let's consider that the detector is a harmonic oscillator. Okay, now my detector is a harmonic oscillator. Think of it as of a molecule, for example, the vibrational levels in a molecule. So far, so good, or not? Questions? All right. Now, unitary transformations in the Hilbert space. So think of the operators in the Heisenberg picture. So the operator x, remember, x is the collection of all the momenta and all the positions. So of course, at a time t, you have an initial condition, and then you evolve the initial operator at a time t, and then you get x of t. That's evolution, what we call in the Hilbert space picture. Now, in phase space, again, if we don't have translation terms in the Hamiltonian, displacement terms in the Hamiltonian, and my original state is centered at zero, then this initial this initial collection of momenta and positions evolve through a linear transformation in phase space. All that I'm saying is that I have my vector of quadratures here, and it evolves somewhere. It rotates, if you want, and moves in the phase space, okay, in the space of p's and x's. This transformation, I mean, I'm not going to get into much detail. This transformation, so the transformations, the same way that transformations are unitary in Hilbert space, the transformations are symplectic in Hilbert space. I don't know how much of that you've seen. This is classical mechanics, actually. classical, so super important classical mechanics, a symplectic formalism, symplectic formulation of classical mechanics. So you can think, okay, phase space. What is the metric of phase space? What plays the role? You know, you're familiar with differential geometry because you've done GR. So you know differential geometry, right? Say that I want to do differential geometry of phase space. Phase space is a funny space. It's a space made of X's and P's, all right? But there is a natural metric in use here. It's the natural metric given by the Poisson bracket. The Poisson bracket is a bilinear form. So that bilinear form, every time that you have a bilinear form, you have something like a metric. Now, the Poisson bracket induces a metric. That metric we call the symplectic form. It's a two-form, as a metric should be. The symplectic form, it's what plays the role of the metric in phase space, in P and X space. Now, the symplectic form, it's kind of interesting. Symplectic form is what, so I define it with the I in there anyway. So in Hilbert space, you get time evolution like that. In phase space, you get time evolution like that. F is made out of the Hamiltonian coefficients. And look at that, the role of the I is played by this omega, this symplectic form. Oh, you know what the square of omega is? The square of omega is minus identity, which is what happens to I, by the way, only that omega is a form. It's it's a two form that is two n-dimensional. This omega is, if you want, so the same way that the metric defines the element of volume in a given space, the metric tells you what's the element of volume. Omega tells you what's the element of volume in phase space. So when you say that transformations preserve volume in phase space, maybe you've heard that before, what they're telling you is transformations preserve the omega, the symplectic form. The omega, remember, is the metric, is to a metric space of X's, if you want. Omega is what plays the role analogous to the metric. Okay? I don't know if that's too much. That's also actually classical. So in fact, if you go to see Lagrange somehow and present Lagrange and Hamilton and all those people, Lagrange, I mean, Hamilton may say, well, what? So you present Lagrange and Legendre. I have a new theory of mechanics. I'm modifying mechanics, and what I'm doing now is instead of doing classical, what you call in those times it wasn't called classical mechanics, it was called mechanics. If you do mechanics like you do, let me modify the theory, including the following. Instead of talking about points in phase space to describe the state of a system, let's talk about distributions to describe systems, right? The probability distributions to describe the configuration of a system. And those probability distributions are Gaussian and nice. And then I can do all the physics of time evolution with symplectic transformations and so on in phase space. Legendre and Lagrange would tell you, all right, that modification of mechanics is not such. I don't see any difference between the mechanics I do and the mechanics you do. And if Lagrange and Legendre actually had the tools of differential geometry that we have now, they would say, what you're doing here is nothing but classical mechanics of two forms instead of scalars. Now, usually the state of a system was described by a scalar, and the evolution was just describing the evolution of points. Here, you're doing classical mechanics of something that is not scalars anymore. It's two forms. Why are you doing that? I don't know. But I wouldn't call that a different theory. This is the natural extension of the theory. If you have objects that in phase space are not scalar, but instead they are two forms, they would evolve like this. They would transform like this. Okay, so this is nothing but actually classical mechanics of funny objects. See what I mean? But Gaussian quantum mechanics is classical mechanics of Gaussian distributions in phase space. Interesting enough, you can have multimode squeezed states that actually are entangled states. So you can have entanglement in this classical mechanics if you want. So one has to be careful. And this I want to illustrate, what is the difference if you are ever asked, what is the difference between quantum and classical? What would you say? It's a tough question. And I think it's a contextual question. What is quantum and what is classical? I think depends on the context that you're asking the question. For example, people say coherent states, are they classical or quantum? How many people would think that a coherent state is classical? How many people would think it's quantum? Okay, there's no opinions on coherent states. Coherent states are very good descriptions for laser light, for example. How many people would think that a thermal state is classical? How many people would say it's quantum? Do you think it's classical? How many people would say it's quantum? All right. Usually, and this is done often, I've heard it often, people said coherent states are the boundary between classical and quantum, has to do with the Poissonian statistics of a coherent state. Also, thermal state, definitely classical. Now, the vacuum state is both a thermal state and a coherent state. Is the vacuum state of a theory quantum or classical? It's definitely not what you would expect for the ground state of a classical theory. A state that is... So one way of quantifying classicality or quantumness is, okay, what is the relative magnitude of the expectation value versus the fluctuations if the state is pure? Then we can talk about classicality. So a Fock state of many, 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 many photons, to me, that thing is pretty classical, even if it's a Fock state. A Fock state of one photon, yeah, if you define it as the ratio between the uncertainty, the expectation value and the uncertainty, the uncertainty over the expectation value, well, that has no uncertainty. So under that criterion, it would be classical. But a Fock state is a single photon state, it's kind of like very quantum. A Gaussian state. A Gaussian state seems classical. Why? Under the assumption that I can describe it with a stochastic classical theory, as in like, it's just a positive probability distribution on phase space. That's a statistical mechanics, classical statistical mechanics last time I checked. If you have a positive probability distribution on phase space, you get a classical theory, a theory that doesn't require quantum. Fokker-Planck will describe it perfectly, right? You can do classical mechanics of that. And then you get entanglement. So all that I'm telling you is that what you call classical and quantum is not a clear-cut question. It depends on the context. For example, quantum superpositions, they're pretty quantum, no? Right? Sure. So people tend to say, yeah, quantum superpositions are quantum, and therefore having coherences in the density matrix is a clear clue of quantumness. No, that's such a basis-dependent statement. You can diagonalize the matrix, and you no longer have coherences. Was the state that was quantum there not quantum now? Well, I guess yes, in a way, it's a basis-dependent statement. So all that I'm saying is just be careful what you call quantum and you call classical. Another one. Oh, yeah, whatever survives, something, if something gets unchanged when h-bar goes to zero, then it's classical. Also dangerous. Imagine that I give you a superposition like this. Can you take h-bar to zero here? And what do you get? I don't see any h-bars in here, right? So a quantum superposition that exists, if you create it, that's a different story. The interactions, we have h-bars there. To create it, you need h-bars. But once it's created, say that we start with that, and then we make h-bar go to zero. That thing doesn't disappear. So the phenomenology of quantum superpositions does not disappear when you take h-bar to zero. Other things disappear. Again, all those things is just to show contradictions in different ways of approaching, yeah, what is quantum and what is classical. One has to be careful what we call quantum and in what context, all right? Then again, Gaussian quantum mechanics cannot do anything that classical mechanics of funny objects can do. Still, it's got entanglement. Now, there are papers that say that to see that entanglement, you need a non-Gaussian element. So eventually, prove, not say. Eventually, if you want to acknowledge that entanglement, you need to do something non-Gaussian. Maybe your measurements are non-Gaussian. But time evolution can be Gaussian. All right, that said, the cool thing, though, using Gaussian quantum mechanics is that you have a Hilbert space, say, n harmonic oscillators. Your Hilbert space is infinite dimensional. The phase space that you have is actually the covariance matrix. All the numbers that you need to describe your Gaussian state is just a collection of 2n by 2n numbers. So we've reduced from infinite dimensions to 2n by 2n. Okay? So we reduce the complexity of this. Also, the geometry of the Hilbert space is metric, induced by an inner product too. The geometry of the symplectic space of phase space is symplectic. That means that the composite, a composite density matrix, it's not the tensor product of the, sorry. You might have two subsystems, sigma A, sigma B. Okay? The space, let's say the space they live, the phase space of system A and system B. The total phase space is not the tensor product of the two spaces. It's the direct sum of the two spaces. That makes a huge difference. Like huge, as like night and day. To do partial tracing here, how do you get, if I give you a matrix and I tell you this matrix lives in a direct sum, it's an operator on a space that is the direct sum of two spaces, and I want just the partial matrix that corresponds to the first subspace, what do you do if it's a direct sum? You just pick the block. You just throw out everything and keep the block that you're looking at, because it's a direct sum, not a tensor product. So partial tracing in Gaussian quantum mechanics becomes trivial. Trivial, as we will see. All right. Let's just do, let's just do entanglement harvesting and let's learn a little bit about what Gaussian quantum mechanics look like, I guess, instead of knowing much more about it. I'll be very happy to answer any questions you may have. All right, imagine you have an optical cavity. Let's prepare the state in the vacuum and let's throw two detectors through the cavity. Two atoms going through an optical cavity, preparing the vacuum. We know this thing will get entangled. These two detectors, I mean, the regimes are right, because of entanglement harvesting at the very least, they will get entangled. Nice. Perfect. That's fantastic. What happens if I don't have the vacuum? Say that I have a thermal state at room temperature, for example. What happens if I do the same thing? Tough luck. Temperature kills entanglement harvesting. You can do it at finite temperature, you can do it, but it's exponentially suppressed with temperature, your ability to harvest entanglement. So tough luck, right? Because in experiments you don't have vacua, right? You have kind of like very low temperature thermal states. Is that going to be a problem? Well, not really. Let's see. So entanglement harvesting may not be a source, could be okay to just show that it exists and nice, but as a source of entanglement may not be the best. Because having a black box, it's expensive, and you have to cool it down to near vacuum, and you want to do that, there are other much better ways to get entangled, things entangled. Just look at them, I guess. They get entangled just alone on their own. Now, the amount of entanglement extracted vanishes quickly as temperature increases, so that's not good. And one would say, okay, fine, but what if we repeat the process iteratively? Is it possible that by just sending atoms to the cavity, I manipulate the cavity to a fixed point that has some interesting properties, such as I can harvest entanglement from it? Can I grow the ability to get entanglement on the cavity by throwing atoms? Now, this is a question that cannot be answered perturbatively, but it can be answered non-perturbatively, and for that we use Gaussian quantum mechanics. All right, so look at this. Initial state of field and atoms. You have two atoms that are initially uncorrelated, say in the ground state, as I have here, and the field. And nice thing, the total covariance matrix is just a direct sum. If there are no correlations, it's just block one, block two, block three. That's one of the niceness of symplectic spaces, linear operators, bilinear forms in symplectic spaces. All right, let's say that I throw, the initial matrix is just zeros everywhere except for the diagonal blocks. Now, I throw the atoms through the cavity, and I modify the state of the cavity to a rho prime. Now, that means that I evolve my symplectic matrix through my covariance matrix through a symplectic transformation. Again, unitary transformations preserve probabilities, symplectic transformations preserve the symplectic form. Unitary transformations preserve the norm of vectors in the Hilbert space. Symplectic transformations preserve the volume of phase space. All right, so the equivalent to a unitary transformation would be a symplectic transformation in phase space. So this transformation yields a final state that contains correlations between the different systems. Those are correlation terms. Okay, step number two. Let's throw out the atoms and get a fresh pair. The nice thing, again, is that it's very easy to trace out the previous atoms. So I add two new atoms, and I throw out the others, just neglecting the blocks corresponding to the others. So think of this matrix having also the first atoms, but I just got the blocks corresponding to the field and the new atoms. And I repeat the process. So I generate another step. And then what I do is I iterate the process several times. Keep sending, keep sending, keep sending. And I ask, is there any fixed point to these dynamics? Well, this is how you calculate the fixed point. So several techniques. I mean, it's a linear map after all. So what we do is vectorize the linear map first and find a fixed point of application. I mean, there are techniques that would allow you to find fixed points of a linear map. In fact, it's guaranteed that there is a fixed point. There are several theorems that tell you that if linear maps are of a particular kind, fixed points always exist. That's what many modern computational techniques are based on, like optimization. Like when people do machine learning and so on, they rely on the existence of those fixed points. How fast you can get to them, that's a different story, but they exist. So first, you prove that there exists a fixed point, and you actually get a close expression for that fixed point, something that you can calculate without having to iterate many times. You actually can calculate beforehand. Now, you can ask several questions. How long does it take? So, okay. Does it take an infinite amount of time to reach a fixed point? Can you reach it in finite times? Can you extract entanglement from that fixed point? That's the most important one if you actually want to use it as a source of entanglement. Now, the first thing that you see is that, sure, entanglement can be extracted. Look at this. This is particularly interesting. This is the vacuum. You start extracting some entanglement, as we know. But then as you go, you extract less and less entanglement, although it seems that it's kind of stabilizing somewhere. This is some thermal state of half the gap of, so if this is an atom, temperature of 0.5 means half the temperature of the sun. So you do not extract, this is very, very hot, that's what I mean. You do not extract entanglement at the beginning, but suddenly at some point, you are extracting entanglement. When you do many times the passing through of the atoms. And even higher temperature, what it does is displaces the time where you actually start extracting entanglement. The fixed point is entangling. So these things are going to the fixed point. They haven't reached it yet. It's low in reaching the fixed point. In fact, we can zoom out. Okay, and we see that increasing temperature does delay how long it takes in terms of cycles to reach the fixed point, but not much, actually. They reach the fixed point at similar scales, all of them. All right, interesting. Oh, I mean, I don't have it. Interesting. One question you can ask is, cool, but I don't have the entropy cost in here. Cool, but then what happens if I keep repeating this process forever? I kind of lied to you. Fixed points are guaranteed to exist as long as you have finite dimensions. If you don't have finite dimensions, the fixed point is not guaranteed to be reached. It may exist in the closure of that space, but it's not guaranteed to exist. You have infinite dimensions here because you have optical cavities, infinite number of modes. Is this a real fixed point? In fact, you can actually compute what's the buildup of entropy doing this process, and you find out that it's not a real fixed point, unfortunately. It's a metastable fixed point. What you get is that you remain the fixed point until you do the cycles millions and millions of times, and then you start going down again, and in the end, you won't be able to extract entanglement. What's going on there? All right. So when you are, so there's a mechanism, there's a way to hand-wavily explain this kind of mechanism that I don't know if he likes it, though, but I'd really like it. I call it the Kempf hammer. So the hammer, this idea of the hammer is what happens if you hit something, let's say you hit something with a hammer that is really cold. So when you hit something with a hammer, in general, something that is relatively cold, you hit it with a hammer, you're heating it up, right? Every time you hit it, you heat it up, right? Okay, but every time you hit it, also, you're like putting the hammer in kind of thermal contact with it. So if the hammer is really cold, it's not unthinkable that there's some energy transfer as well to the hammer if you let it there long enough when you hit. So on the one hand, you have a mechanism of heating up and a mechanism of cooling down. How does that go here? Well, you start sending atoms through the cavity. That perturbs the cavity, makes a perturbation in the field. That perturbation in the field starts the field. It's like heating it up a little bit. It's abruptly, just suddenly atoms have come by. Now, those atoms are in the ground state, and they spend some time flying through the cavity. Because of that, those atoms are taking energy off the cavity. They're in the ground state, they're getting excited. And if they spend enough time in the cavity, they will take it mainly from the resonant modes. As we saw, for long enough interactions, only modes close to resonant would be non-negligible in the interaction with the detector. So it's taking energy from the resonant modes. However, they put tiny amounts of energy into the high energy modes. When they enter, the abrupt perturbation when they enter puts energy in all the spectrum. The higher energy modes are off resonant. They don't have enough time to thermalize with the detector as the detectors go by. So you have a buildup of energy in the higher modes. It's slow. It's a slow process. But you have a buildup of energy. So you find a fixed point as long as you put a cutoff in your cavity. And then there's a fixed point. If you remove the cutoff, cutoff means there's a ultraviolet cutoff in your cavity. If you remove the cutoff, you get something like this. And then far, far away, around Kitchener or so, you would see the thing going down. That buildup of energy will kick you out eventually, but it's very slowly building up. Luckily enough, optical cavities don't trap gamma rays. So optical cavities are very leaky. Realistic optical cavities are really have implemented a natural UV cutoff. They do not trap that energy. That energy that is being built up in high energy modes will escape the cavity very fast, and hopefully you can still do this and grow entanglement. Now, you need to do it of the order of 10 to the 4 to get a Bell pair with usual couplings. So in principle, with a protocol like this, you can get Bell pairs by just throwing atoms through a cavity and distilling the entanglement from those atoms. Ah, that was a little bit fast. Are there any questions? I just wanted you to be exposed to this. I'm sorry, this is kind of different philosophy to the rest of the course. Yes?
So what's actually causing this jump?
Oh, you are, so the jump, the entanglement in itself is a discontinuous thing because remember, negativity would be continuous because it's the sum of the negative eigenvalues, right? So if you get the eigenvalues you know will be negative and you plot them, it's a continuous thing. But it's the maximum between zero and the minus sum of negative eigenvalues. So there's a transition point where your eigenvalues of the partially transposed density matrix become positive. And that is when you start getting non-zero negativity. That's why it's discontinuous. It's basically because I cut off. If you keep plotting those the sum of those eigenvalues, you get a negative negativity. That is, you make it zero because it's the minimum between the maximum between zero and that. What's going on here is you start from a thermal state and you're kind of purifying it a little bit through the interaction with the detectors, enough to get entanglement out. Now, interesting enough, you can ask, is this a thermalization process? Am I cooling down the states? No, actually you depart from thermality very fast. This is a non-thermal process. So at every step, you don't have enough time for the atoms to thermalize with the cavity. The field is driven in a non-thermal kind of way. Yep.
It's causing the oscillations in the other one.
Okay, I can tell you what scales. I mean, these atoms have a time scale omega when they cross the cavity. And that time scale omega is not the same. So, of course, they will be resonant with one mode, but the time they spend in the cavity is not enough to neglect every other single mode. Well, as I discussed, even high energy modes get populated. So these beatings and these oscillations are the effect of the fact that we are all the modes are being populated in ways that are uneven. So you get like many, it's like coupling many harmonic oscillators of different frequencies to the same detector. So you get beats, that kind of thing. These scales are related to the omega scale of the problem. All right, any more questions about that? Okay, so I hope that I have at least sold you, maybe not convinced you, and that's fine. Because you can go, the good thing I think is that you have now the tools to do the calculations yourself if you don't believe them, or to find problems in them, maybe, if you have them. At least I've told you that there are results out there that can use entanglement harvesting in a way that builds up entanglement, and you can actually farm entanglement from the vacuum, which is kind of cool. You have a black box, which is an optical cavity or something, that you don't care what state it is, because you can drive it to a fixed point. You keep iterating this protocol, and you can get out Bell pairs out of it. So getting things entangled doesn't have a lot of merit, I guess, because you can get it for free just getting out from the vacuum. I mean, in ways, of course. I mean, if you want to control that entanglement, you don't do that. Anyway, the next thing we're going to see, and that's next week, just so you know, is like, okay, what about communication? When people talk about communication, oftentimes there are two different ways. The most common way to talk about it is two different ways. A very computational, let's call it computer scientist kind of approach, which is like, yeah, I have time evolution. That defines a quantum channel. I have an input and an output. What happens with it? But that oftentimes does not take into account anything that has to do with relativity whatsoever. That's the usual thing. The other way is within relativity. Oh, yeah, you send a pulse of light to communicate. You use classical signals. In fact, there's a famous book written by a famous author, famous physicist. I'm not going to say the name, but there's a book out there that a very famous person that knows a lot about relativity says things like, of course, you always need to send a photon or light in order to communicate through a massless field. I mean, there's no matter what you do, I mean, maybe an arbitrary low frequency photon, but maybe you always need to send light to send information. So a very simplified way of looking at transmission of information, which is, yeah, to transmit information, you need to transmit some sort of carrier of information. Okay? We're going to do something that challenges the two approaches, I guess. One is, okay, what happens if we communicate through a fully relativistic interaction? We use a quantum field to communicate. That shouldn't be massless quantum field. We do that all the time. We have Wi-Fi in our phones. We're using a massless field to communicate, indeed. But we are not fully using all the nature of the field. The field, we're using the classical nature of the field, right? We're using like classical antennas, and we are transmitting classical information through those classical antennas. Can we do better if we have quantum antennas? Can we use the quantum nature of things that couple to the field, and perhaps even the quantum nature of the field, to send signals in a better way? We're going to find out about that. We're going to talk about a protocol called quantum collect calling. You know, names in what we do in RQI is giving names to things. And that's the best thing we do, to be honest. So we're going to see a protocol called quantum collect calling that is about transmission of information without transmission of energy. Okay, using properties of the field. Actually, a classical property of the field, but quantum field, and using quantum antennas. And that's going to be a couple lectures, three lectures or so. We're going to do math this time, so we're going to actually show what it looks like. Maybe that will put your mind at ease about causality. I don't know, you were a little bit fuzzy about it, I guess, as in like don't trust it completely, which is good, something I consider positive. We're going to see how the communication, even if you have entanglement, communication is fully causal. You will not be able to see anything about detector A that's spatially separated from B. And we will actually show what are the implications in cosmology of quantum collect calling, because there are implications in cosmology. And after that, we'll see the last thing of the course, which is the last week. It's going to be quantum energy teleportation, which is the converse of that. Quantum energy teleportation is, instead of sending energy by energy propagating through the quantum field from one point to another? No, we don't have energy propagation. We have some information from the field here. We send the information over. With that information, we extract energy from the field. We're going to see that protocol that was developed by Masahiro Hota, and we're going to see a kind of cool toy kind of spin-off of that we did, in which we actually use this protocol to prepare negative energy density states in the quantum field, of the kind that can lead to exotic solutions to Einstein equations. And that's going to be the rest of the course. Huh? Anyway, if you have any questions, please ask. I know this was fast and it was long. Sorry about that. I'm going to stop now. But and again, feel free to ask me any questions. I hope that wasn't too obscure. Please do feel free to ask.